Hello and welcome to Cobden Centre Radio with me, Andy Duncan. Tonight, in our third show, the heroic Brian Micklethwaite interviews Toby Baxendale, our Cobden Centre chairman, and probes Toby with two general questions. First, how does Toby think Britain arrived in its current financial situation? Toby's extended answer covers the first 38 minutes of this interview and almost 200 years of British financial history. In the second half of the interview, Brian explores with Toby how he thinks the whole British financial system can be fixed. Although the entire programme does last for over 1 hour, I thought Cobden Centre listeners would be stoic enough to want to hear the whole thing.
Toby, what's been going on and what should we do?
Well, what's been going on in the financial system has been going on for many years. We have a system of Soviet-style planning of the production and distribution of money. By that, I mean we have a central planner for money. It's called the Bank of England, and particularly the Monetary Policy Committee. And they underscore the whole financial system by being the lender of last resort. And what we mean by this is, on top of the central banking system, you have, I prefer to call them branches. I prefer to call something like HSBC, Barclays Bank, RBS as branches of the central bank. That's how I prefer to conceptually see them and economically see them, although, of course, they're entirely separate legal entities, and they have HSBC exclusively private sector shareholders, RBS up until, you know, and Lloyds up until X number of months ago, it might even be over a year ago now, they would have been exclusively private, but of course have public ownership and private ownership. But essentially, they cannot function without, be they 100% privately owned, they cannot function without the support and of the central bank. And this is done because they operate a system of fractional reserves, fractional reserve banking. And what that means for the person who is not necessarily, you know, in receipt of this knowledge, is that if you, Brian, pick up, let's say, your £100 worth of savings in real notes and coins, and you decide to walk up to Barclays Bank, which is a private bank, and you decide to put in those £100 of notes and coins into a deposit, you're actually engaging in a lending arrangement with the bank, whereby you are the lender to the bank for the sum of £100. Now, that comes as a great shock to the vast majority of people because they think they're depositing their money there for safekeeping.
They think it's still their property.
They think it's still their property. Mm. But the act of deposit since 1811, in the case of Carr versus Carr, stipulates very clearly that you are in fact entering into a loan agreement with your bank. Mm. Now, this bank may come, your bank, let's call it Bank A, now in receipt of your money, or formerly your money, it's now loan money to the bank, then goes along to, say, Bank B, where they have a fishy customer called Toby, the entrepreneur, who needs to invest in some plant and kit and machinery, and they knock on the door of Toby, the fish merchant, and say, would you like to borrow £100 off us? And Toby, the entrepreneur, says, yes, I'm very happy and delighted to borrow £100 from you. We borrow the £100, and I bank it in said Bank B again. Now, Toby, the entrepreneur, has a claim to £100, and Brian, the saver, has a claim to £100. So from our original £100, we now have £200.
And we can't both be right.
We can't both be right. Well, we can both be right under the current law, because, I mean, that's how the current law is. Mm. We have the same property titlements to the same thing. So I would argue that there's actually being a querying in the pitch of property rights by allowing fractional reserve banking to exist. The problem is that in this country, with no legal reserve requirements, and many free market people orientating disposed people would have supported the abandonment of a reserve requirement by the Thatcher government in the 80s. There's no reserve requirement. So technically, of your £100 invested in the banking system, which you think you're saving in the banking system, actually all of it can be relent out again, and there could be nothing there for you whatsoever. So the reality is £3 of every £100 is kept in the banking system on average, in the UK licensed banking system, £3 in every £100. So
if I lend £100, we're talking another sort of 3,000, whatever the number is.
£3,300 is then created and lent out.
In effect, to use a phrase I've read of you using, out of thin air.
Yes, out of thin air. Ex novo, out of thin air, created from nothing.
Mm.
Now, the interesting thing, there are several interesting things to observe there, is that the cash, physical notes and coins exists. That's what you put into the system. The ex novo creation, the creation out of thin air, is in fact, how I prefer to describe it, is a bank giving you an IOU. So in return for your £100 that has been deposited, they give you a bank statement which says Brian Micklethwaite, £100 on deposit, which is in effect an IOU from the bank. So when you look at your bank statement, I'd always encourage people to look at it as saying, right, this is my great big long list of IOUs. Yeah?
Yes.
So we can now establish that the physical units are real and the IOU is real, because that IOU, you know, you can go and transact from your bank statement. You can go and transact via check, via direct debit, via standing order, with other banks. So essentially they're just reshuffling around IOUs all the time to facilitate the exchange. Now, the system can only exist because let's say for example Brian wants £10 off his £100. Yeah?
Yeah.
Toby has already spent the £100, so Brian can't get back.
So the bank goes to Toby.
The bank goes to Toby and Toby says, hey, you've loaned it to me on a year basis. So there's a mismatch of our maturity profiles. You want yours now. It's on demand after all. I've been lent it for a year. So what does the bank do? The bank goes overnight to its partner, its supporting parent, if you like, the Bank of England, and says, oh, I need a sub overnight, and it borrows overnight. So it will sell the loan to Toby the entrepreneur as part of good security to the Bank of England and have that discounted in exchange for money. Now, money to then pay Brian, and that's how the system continues to exist. So the fractional reserve banking system can only exist because it's got the state and banking apparatus underneath.
And the obvious worry is, what if all of those people who think they own between them £3,300 on the basis of the £100 that I originally lent the bank, thinking all I've done was storing my own money at the bank, if they all suddenly want the money at the same time?
Well, then you have a bank run, and we witnessed that with Northern Rock.
And the government is dragged into it big time.
Yes, and the government has a choice then. If the overnight discounting windows, which usually sort these, hitherto from, a century, more than a century, have sorted out these little local difficulties between the private sector banks being bailed out by the state, if this is on such a large scale, the only solution that the central bank has got is to print more money and put it into circulation, but this will monetize the debt and essentially cause inflation, or do what Gordon Brown did and issue a state-backed bailout effectively on all deposits and hope people don't walk through the door and demand their deposits, because then you're back to the first option, which is to monetize the debt debase the currency, essentially, and print everyone out of trouble, because they've already those things already exist. They've already come into existence. The inflation, if you like, has already been created, but no one really wishes to realise this.
An obvious question arises, which is that this doesn't sound like a particularly new arrangement, all this fractional reserve banking.
No.
Why has it suddenly blown up in our faces now?
Well, yeah, I think you can trace it back to several trigger events. I mean, fundamentally, what I'm describing to you, I hope you realise, is a system that is absolutely unsustainable long term. It exists on a confidence trick.
Yes.
Now should economics and business, the whole of commerce, rest on a confidence trick? I think not. But with regard to some key trigger events, in the late 70s, and then reaffirmed by Bill Clinton in America, banks were mandated to lend to subprime lenders. Subprime,
yes,
borrowers, I beg your pardon, were,
yes,
mandated to do that. To actually...
That's to say people who normally wouldn't have been able to borrow money because,
yeah,
they were just not...
Not creditworthy enough.
Yeah.
And this was done for various social reasons. You know, let's say, I'll give you an example of a, you know, single mother on benefits who has three offspring and she has to look after, she can't go out into...
I think it's clear why that sort of thing is done.
Mm.
Okay, gathered pace.
Well, the reason why that gathered pace is because the liberalisation of the financial markets. Because before, there were much higher reserve ratios. So the ability of a bank to be able to create money ex novo, ad infinitum, was contained. In America, I think they still have a 10% reserve ratio. It's been much higher historically. In this country, we have a 0% reserve ratio.
When was that introduced?
In the 80s, it was a liberalisation policy on faulty free market thinking.
I was going to say, it sounds like a horrible... horrible sort of distortion of the word liberalisation.
That's right. It's like when I liken it to when the railways were privatised in this country. Despite the fact that they were created individually, each of those lines, by the private sector, by capitalist entrepreneurs who sought to raise funds from the public, who built railway lines, who built the trains that go on top of them, who built the hotels along the way, We denationalised by keeping the rail network intact as a monopoly provider of rail services, and then we let the private sector compete on top for the usage of the lines.
Which makes the railway companies a lot like those banks you were describing at the beginning. Licensees of the government, really.
Yeah, they're licensees of the government. So you then do a free market reform on top of a status system, and you get outcomes that you don't expect as a free market thinker, because you haven't been intellectually...
Well, you kind of do expect them if you're an intelligent free market thinker. I mean, if you were, as it were, to liberalise your business and just kind of abolish a lot of the disciplines that your business actually depends on, that's not what most of us mean by liberalisation.
No, that's right.
Most of us mean you and people like you being allowed to operate your judgment about what sort of controls you should impose on your own business, rather than just saying, oh, to hell with it, do what you want, fellas.
That's exactly right. And that's why the momentum suddenly takes place in the mid-80s.
Mm.
And then we saw the first boom bust that we had towards the Lawson boom, I think it was called in this country, the bust, in the early 90s. And then really from the mid-90s, this was the Greenspan put, where you saw a massive, I mean, it was a tripling of the money supply in America. Because remember, the money supply, again, is notes and coins, which is the tiny little bit at the bottom, and then the rest of it is these demand deposits that function as money that we're discussing. You saw a tripling of that in the United States of America, and a similar effect here in the United Kingdom.
And of course, I mean, I've been making it sound as if everything has been running smoothly until very recently, and then suddenly it all blew up in our faces. But I mean, there was a previous huge episode very like this in the 1920s and 1930s, was there not?
Yes, and it is exactly the same. It's caused
the same pattern. The 20s sort of functioning like the 80s, and the big bust at the beginning of the 30s is pretty much what we're having now.
That's right. And again, the credit-fueled nature of it is a well documented.
And so you get this kind of multiplier effect in this kind of illusory good times. Easy money, lots and lots of people investing in lots and lots of businesses. Then suddenly, there's a downturn.
Yeah. Well, the reason why the downturn is triggered is classic Austrian theory of the business cycle. Because what you see happening if you're a banker and you can create credit out of thin air. And not out of real people's savings, you bring forth to your mind what I call suboptimal plans of entrepreneurs. So the best plan, the
known
best
to
plan,
the rest of us is stupidity.
Stupidity.
Yes.
Yes. The boom period. To an Austrian economist, is actually the error cycle. That's when the error cycle
when the mistakes are made.
Yes, that's when the big mistakes are being made. And it can only be made by cheap credit because rational bankers place their money with their safest bets first. So you can only place it. You get more and more marginal as you go along with these. And they even refer to them as bets. You know, it's not even in. Many years ago, a bank would never even dream or consider that it bets with clients' money. That would be you'd be walked out of a bank and sort of summarily executed for even having such a disastrous thought because you would consider yourself a fiduciary to your client.
Yes, this brings us on to a very important point, which is that one of the I referred to how I might be a devil's advocating. One of the things the devil says right now is that people like you and me are arguing, to put it in colloquial terms, the lunatics should be put in charge of the asylum. You know, here are these bankers who made all these ridiculously stupid bets, as you've called them, and here we are saying there should be a complete free market in banking. Well, what the hell are we talking about? The answer is that in a completely free market where people do not have the government as their lender of last resort, that the buck stops with them, a totally different sort of person and a totally different kind of atmosphere prevails in the entire financial system. And you've just alluded to it.
That's right.
The kinds of bankers and the kinds of attitudes that prevail in the banking industry are those of extreme caution and carefulness and fiduciary responsibility and a very nice understanding of their legal obligations and of what they can and can't get away with. Well, which is, of course, in complete contrast to the atmosphere that prevailed in recent decades.
Yes, well, the fiduciary element and the language of the fiduciary has almost evaporated, and you'll see it's the language of the gambler. And gambling is equated with risk-taking. And that's the thing. That's the prevalent language in the banking environment. And you're seeing it suspended itself, if you like, when Lehman's went pop, and it's creeping back into the daily language of bankers that you see reported in the press now.
Yeah, the good times are back, and that's what.
Yes, the good times are back.
Drinking and flaunting their red braces, just like it's the good old days.
Yeah, like the good old days. But you see, the reason, going back to what we're saying, the reason why the boom turns to bust. Is whenever money is created out of thin air and is lent to an enterprise, the enterprise uses that money to do something with it. Now, invariably, what it does with it, for example, in this business you're sitting in here, if we're lent money for usually a capital expenditure program, to a certain extent a working capital expenditure program. Working capital lending is very short term. Capital lending, by its very nature, is long term. So what tends to happen with this new money, created out of nothing, we'll invest in plant and kit that we believe will make us more efficient in our production, so that we can do more things for the given amount of resources that we have, create more products and more goods and services. And this is called elongating the structure of our capital.
Yes.
Okay, so we elongate...
So your business becomes more complicated, but the product gets better.
Your product gets better and cheaper. That's the goal. And that fundamentally is the goal of capitalism.
Yes.
Which is ultimately for me to deliver to you as the consumer ever cheaper goods and services. Because that's the way I achieve...
And better and fresher and tastier and whatever I want.
Exactly. And I'm failing if I don't do that.
Yeah.
And we'll come back to that very, very salient. That's a point I'd like us to come back to. But that elongation of the structure of production is a thing that mainstream economists find very difficult to understand, because they view capital as K, a homogeneous blob, whereas capital is heterogeneous. And this is another important point to make. You know, my filleting machines that cut our salmon filleting portions to create more portions than we can by hand is very different to Arsenal Football Stadium.
Yeah, you couldn't just pick up the kit you use for the fishes and just dump them down in Arsenal to sell tickets.
No,
it can't work like that.
It can't work. Capital is heterogeneous.
In short, it's not hard to buy machinery like this, but once you've bought it, you can't just unbuy it.
Yeah, you can't unbuy it and can't turn into anything else. So as this capital in people's businesses is growing, and we're getting more and more complex system, and we're getting more and more production bids resources away from the consumption sector of the economy, because it needs resources to make all this new stuff. Yeah? So you have an elongation of the structure of production. Now, the wages then paid to the people who are making all this new plant, product, kit, and so on and so forth, they then spend in the consumption sector. And this in turn then pulls resources and competes for resources again from the production sector. So you get the consumption sector trying to elongate its profile, if you like. So you get two sides of the whole structure of production competing against each other for resources.
Inflation?
Yes. Well, inevitably, towards the end of the boom, and this is what Mises would call the classic signs of a crack-up boom, is you would see commodity prices massively soaring, and then all of a sudden, you know, the bubble bursts.
We say the bubble bursts. Let's pin down what that actually means. It means businesses finding their costs going up and up, going to the bank, begging for more lending, and at that exact moment finding that lending is also getting more expensive, and very expensive.
Well, have I described it correctly? Well, everything bids up against each other so that nothing becomes affordable.
Yes.
And that's when
just exactly the moment when your bank can't help you.
Yes.
Because it's got problems of its own of exactly this kind.
Well, when you need it the most. So we saw towards the 2006, 7 and 8 we saw the massive final uplifting in prices of commodities, which of course underpins the making of capital, equipment, goods and services and so on and so forth. And we saw that oil price peaking at about $150 a barrel. And then with costs like that in your system, your profit margins are eroded. You go to your bank. Your bank's not really that interested in lending to you, because you're looking like you're becoming a suboptimal business as well.
Bank wants its money back.
Yeah, the bank wants its money back, and it's lent out 33 times to one, and the whole system goes pop, and it goes pop at the marginal one penny. Yeah, because the smallest money unit is one penny in this country. So at some point in time, there is that penny, that is enough to tip the whole thing over. And in Northern Rock's case, there would have been that one penny of demand at the counter, that marginal one penny that would have tipped the whole ship over and sunk it.
Mm.
So that's classic Austrian theory of the business cycle. We had this event nearly played itself out at the dot-com bust, but no bank bailouts were required then. At that point in time, it was enough for Greenspan and the central bankers of the world to embark upon a incredibly low interest rate policy. This is a cheap money policy.
Yes.
Which caused the final.
Well, they just threw more money at everything, didn't they?
Well, threw more credit.
Yes.
I always try and distinguish between,
yes,
you know, money notes and coins and money demand deposits credit.
Well, if you've got other things you want to say, please stop me moving the conversation on. But this brings me on to another even more fundamental question, which is the role of governments in money itself. I think before I switched this machine on, we were talking about how, whereas for the intelligent layman, the idea that your fish distribution business, where we are, could be nationalized is at least an understandable opinion.
Mm.
And the argument that it should not be nationalized, likewise, is a reasonable opinion, certainly a believable opinion.
Mm.
The idea that money itself should not be controlled by politicians, should, as it were, not have a king's or a president's face carved onto the side of it or printed onto it, is almost unthinkable.
Mm.
And yet, well, Austrians hold exactly that money itself should be no more of a politicized industry than your fish distribution.
Well, that's correct. I mean, money is...
Well, how would that work? I mean,
well, there's lots of theoretical confusions that you have to get out of the way first. Money is the final thing for which all goods exchange. I think that's an uncontroversial statement to make. I think most economists would agree to that. Money is created, like language, spontaneously, by no one in particular, but by many people who sought to remove themselves from barter, you know, the exchange, direct exchange of goods against other goods, towards indirect exchange.
I mean, you almost have to invent a kind of parallel world where, I mean, in the real world, as we all know, kings, jumped up gangsters, aristocrats, whatever they are, pretty much immediately money gets into its stride, they take it over if they weren't running it in the first place.
Well,
and they insist that they're the only, and they almost define their power, not only by their monopoly of violence, actually not so much that, but by their monopoly control of money itself, legal tender and all that.
That's
right. But suppose they didn't do that. Suppose they regarded their job as, I don't know, maintaining the law, defending the realm, but as far as money's concerned, it's up to you guys to sort it out amongst yourselves, and I'll be just a customer.
Yes, well, they would...
That's the kind of world we have to imagine, isn't
it? Yes, that would be a much a place. But we don't have to imagine it. It existed for most of mankind's existence. The point being that in latter years, despots at various points in history have decided, oh, this money product, which was invariably gold or silver, if I create a legal tender law, then I can effectively at points in time bring in the people's money, because that's what it was, the people's money, and I can clip a little bit of the value off every single bit of the metal and give it back to them with an impure alloy, and I can keep the surplus, the bunts, for myself. Now, those despots historically did that infrequently, and it's clearly quite risky for them, because extracting the people's wealth like that can invariably mean you've got your,
Now there's some sort of restraint on despots in that they compete with each other. They may not allow competition with their own subjects, but they do compete with one another.
Yes, but when it was a monarchical despot,
it was all more visible and tangible.
Yes. That's right, and it happened a lot less frequently, and the money unit itself was actually still the free market created money unit, i.e. commodity money, right? So that was that's they never They never challenged that until latter days.
We're talking about gold, essentially, aren't we?
Gold and silver and other metallic-based currencies, although in certain societies other things have existed as money. Conch shells is one of the often examples, and in various places in Africa, you know, the number of cows you have and so on and so forth. But primarily, metallic-based money is the free market money. Now, that was still left in situ, although it was abused by despots in the way that we describe, coin clipping being the classic example. The invention of fiat currency or money by decree, by government decree, is the invention of certainly the last...
So that, for you, is the moment when it all starts to go seriously wrong.
Yes, seriously.
And what date would you put to that? Because obviously it sort of happened in different parts of the world in different ways, but roughly when did that occur?
Well, it's difficult to say. You had notes in coins in circulation. Notes, promissory notes, existed from the 1600s.
But they definitely referred to gold and silver.
Well, absolutely, and they weren't government instituted. They were, a goldsmith would issue a promissory note, and you would then go and redeem your note in gold. By 1844, and the Peel Bank Charter Act, you had 23 notes in circulation for every one unit of gold. So there was abuse by the private sector, by the goldsmiths, in their over-issue of notes. But 1694, the invention of the Bank of England, the government had realised that this ability of over-issuing notes was in fact a good thing for the government, because what they could do, in terms of paying for their debt, their indebtedness, if they overissued notes themselves on their own deposits, then they could effectively get something for nothing. So,
a disguised taxation system.
Yeah, it's all a disguise. All that overissuing is a disguised system. So you had certainly both methods, private and public.
So in other words, you can't point to one date. You've got to think of a sort of graph of,
no, I think
of
it's
malpractice.
Smith's, malpractice, yeah. It's Adam Smith's comment that always comes to mind. There's a lot of ruin in a nation.
Yes.
So these things happen incrementally and over periods of time. But the sort of flagrant abuse of the system starts happening with the invention of the Federal Reserve in 1913 in America. For us, war, any big major war, be it Napoleonic War or be it the First World War or the Second World War, is massive specie suspension.
Because governments are thinking short term rather than long term.
Yes, well, to finance a war effort, you can't do it through direct taxation because the people probably wouldn't have it. So you finance it through making sure, I mean, Churchill's a classic example in 1925, I think off the top of my head, before World War One, the pound exchanged for $4, bought $4.20 worth of stuff. After the First World War, it bought $3.60 worth of stuff. So massive devaluation in the preceding years. Churchill put us back on the gold standard at $4.20. So if you overprice your debt, in effect, you have less to pay back. So governments have used that trick in this country, certainly in great wars. But if you look at the last time sterling was defined as a commodity, in just before the outbreak of the First World War, one quarter of an ounce of gold was what sterling was called. So, you know, the two things should be viewed as being interchangeable. One quarter of an ounce of gold happens to be called sterling. Sterling happens to be called one quarter of an ounce of gold. Now, if you take the gold price now today, I think that would mean a pound sterling should buy £170 worth of goods. So that's the government's legacy of it being in control in the last hundred years of sterling. So the government's legacy to its people is we've decreased the value of your sterling by 99 plus percent. So as custodians of our money, I'd rather have a despot like Henry VIII, who debased it by two thirds, is better than all the current governments. And Emperor Nero, in his most absurdly despotic stage in his lifetime, I think took about 5% off the value of the Roman coin at times. So perversely, there's an argument to say that despotism is better for the purchasing power of your money than modern governments. But that's what we've seen.
The argument that free marketeers like you and me would use to the people who say, oh, but you've got to have the government to, you know, control things, is, well, the last 10 minutes of what you've been saying, that they've done an absolutely appalling job of...
Well, in terms of
the very standards they set themselves of maintaining stability and...
Yeah. They've given us no fiduciary responsibility. Us as citizens have had no fiduciary responsibility from the government, because they have systematically, at 2 or 3% a year, eroded our wealth and our purchasing power. And that's an utter disgrace. Now, the fact that...
But it's not some... I mean, 3% eroding of purchasing power, that's... You kind of expect that from any government, that sort of chipping away. It's the lurch into catastrophe of recent...
Yeah.
Actually, well, recent, very recent years, and the same sort of thing that happened in...
Well, Brian, I'll caution you to be very careful when you say
3%. 3%, yeah, 3% piles up, it adds up, doesn't it?
Because exactly. Yeah. And you imagine if you're on fixed income, yes, like a pensioner,
yeah,
and you've got, say, 30 years of life left to live,
yeah,
3% a year, you're going to be impoverished by the end of it. If you're poor and you're on state handouts or charity, you've got no ability, like myself, as a working, you know, person, to try and jump ahead and keep ahead of inflation and the erosion of my purchasing power. So I'd always counsel caution, because it's actually the poor the people who've stopped working are the ones who are given the biggest kick in the teeth by this.
And the argument that we both use for a totally free market, in actually including money itself as well as everything that depends on the people producing money, is that this arrangement will produce exactly the kind of stability and intelligent balancing of costs and concerns and what consumers want that you see in other industries, the one like yours, where you must all the time be thinking, well, is that fish perhaps diminishing in supply? Is it for some reason becoming less tasty? Who knows why? Are there other fishes from other parts of the world that are becoming easier to obtain? Maybe we should switch to those. All those sorts of decisions that you make, that's exactly the kind of thing that would happen in a completely free market banking world. You wouldn't see either a complete abolition of credit and nobody getting lent any money, nor would you see this profligate, you know, have a loan, it doesn't matter, culture that precedes that moment when the door slams in everybody's faces.
Yeah.
And that's the argument that we put for a free market in all of
this.
And we add to it, we don't have that now. We've got, as you've been saying, government, relentless government control of all this, and government backing it for what it's worth of all of this.
That's right.
My final question, therefore, is, what can we do to move from the world we're in now to the world we want?
Right. Well, this is actually remarkably simple, what can be done. That's the good news. The bad news is, conceptually, it can be quite difficult to understand. But I will now try and explain. If you think about what we discussed about right at the very beginning, Brian depositing £100 into the banking system and thinking it's his, and the bank lending it out 33 times. So we have one unit, and then we have 33 units of stuff created out of thin air. And we've established that stuff created out of thin air does function as money, because from your bank account itself, you can go out and you can buy goods and services via check, via a debit card, direct debit or standing order. So it fulfills the function of being called being money, because it allows you to exchange for the final goods and services. Now, we also established that they're just journal entries in a bank account. They're IOUs. That's all they are. They're not notes and coins, they're IOUs. So if you imagine yourself with a pint glass and you've got only 5% or 3% of that pint glass full, and you've got the rest of it full up with air, to a certain extent you could say it's full, that glass. It's full of beer and it's full of air. Yeah?
Yep.
There's 3% beer and there's 97% air. But essentially that glass is full.
Yeah? It all works as money.
And it all works and it all functions as money.
What's the change you make?
So the change that you can make is you can say, well, I'm going to fill that glass up fully with beer. So it's still 100% full. Yeah? It just happens to be full with all beer as opposed to beer and air. Yeah? So what you can do...
So this is the whole idea of fractional reserve banking basically gets switched off, is that right?
Yeah, it gets turned off to become 100% reserve banking.
Right.
And how you can do that overnight with no pain to anybody is you can print, in this country I think it will be about 1.7 trillion of notes, and you can stick it in to all the demand deposits. So when Brian wakes up in the morning and he goes to his bank, yeah, he no longer has a bank IOU, he has something that says Brian has £100 in cash in our vault. In the bank
account. So I continue to own the contents of my bank account after I've deposited it.
Well, remember, you never owned the contents of it historically.
No, I didn't.
You've always lent it.
Oh, it switches back to being my property.
Yeah, it switches back to being your property.
Yes.
And then we have a very clear claim. Brian owes £100, and it's being custodianed, mm-hmm. safe kept in a bank for him. Now, the immediate concern that people have is that must be massively inflationary, because we all know if you produce more of one thing and everything else remains the same, it will become cheaper. Now, it's entirely neutral to inflation. There's no inflation whatsoever, because so much as we've printed and filled up the glass and filled up all the bank vaults and filled up all the bank deposits, on the flip side of the equation there, we've deleted all the bank IOUs. So the banks no longer have any creditors. Those demand deposits don't exist, because just as they can't come from nothing, yeah, mm-hmm. they can go back to being nothing at a simple erasion, get the rubber out and erase the ledger. Yeah? So you can move to a system in an entirely non-inflationary way, preserves people's property rights and the property rights they think they have, but they don't actually have it as a matter of law, and make 100% reserve banking. Now, if you then think of the banking system, a bank would have a balance sheet pre-reform. It will have its cornerstone capital, i.e. the money put in by the shareholders. That's what sets the company up in the first place, the bank. And then it would have its creditors on the left-hand side of the balance sheet. And they were people like Brian, who mm-hmm. had lent historically the £100. Yeah. And then it would have, on the asset side, the right-hand side of the balance sheet, it would have those loans to entrepreneurs, the loans to the Tobys of the world.
Yeah.
Now, that's how it exists pre-reform. Post-reform, if we've eliminated their demand deposits, because meaning the government, and it's only the government can do this, it's a constructivist proposal, it's the only way.
Well, it has to be, because that's the state we're in now.
That's the state we're in now. If it's printed up all the money and given it to the depositors, the money that they thought they had in the first place, and the banking system no longer has current creditors, then on the creditor side of the balance sheet, post-reform, there's nothing. Yeah? So the banks don't have any current creditors. So beautifully, you now see, post-reform, a bank with its shareholders' capital at the bottom, then on the left-hand side of the balance sheet, now nothing, no current creditors, and on the right-hand side of the balance sheet, only assets. So all of a sudden overnight, the banks now have a new net worth 1.7 trillion times higher than the previous net worth.
How does that change everybody's behaviour for the better? It sounds as if you've just changed the labels rather than the essence of what's going on.
That's right. We'll come to that. So with that banking system, and this is with the new spec banking system where you've got 100% reserves, you've got someone like Jesus Huerto de Soto, who, following the great work of Irving Fisher in the 1930s, who proposed a similar system. This is not new to the body of knowledge. The 100% case for 100% reserve. You could then lift up or lift out of the banking system £1.7 trillion worth of assets, because you've gifted it on one side by removing their creditors. So if you then, why give the bankers a one-off gift of 1.7 trillion quid? Well, you don't have to. You can then take that money, you can take those loans that the likes of the Tobys have been granted and are paying back, and you could use that to discharge entirely the national debt. Overnight, the national debt could be repaid. This would mean we wouldn't have a deficit, and this would mean the money that goes to the deficit, the £40 billion that we're paying on interest repayments, which is larger than the education budget of this country, we could give as an immediate tax cut back to the people. Now, that tax cut, just to give you a flavour of the magnitude, it would be one third of all income tax. So you could give a one third tax cut as a result of this proposal on income tax. So restructuring the banking system like that, you get a safe banking system whereby your money is entirely safe. If a bank run happens, if you all go into the bank, you can pull out your cash. Simple as that. It's open everyone in the world. Do the same, who's part of this reform proposal. You can also then, in addition, pay off entirely the national debt, stop the deficit, and give a good tax cut. Now, this should be something we should be seriously looking at. And then going forward, lending takes place in the time-honoured traditional fashion of time deposits. And a time deposit is where someone like Brian walks in and says, I have my £100, I deposit. I'd like a rate of interest. And the bank say, well, we're happy to offer you 5%. You say, thank you very much. The terms and conditions of you getting the coupon of 5% is that you lock your money away for 3 months, 6 months, a year, 5 years, 10 years, or whatever it happens to be. The further out you lock away your money for, and you relinquish your claim of ownership on it for, the higher the rate of your return. Now, half of all lending in this country happens that way anyway.
What you've described sounds quite familiar.
Yeah. If you bought a corporate bond from Tesco, for example, and they are offering now, I think, a 7% return, you might lock your money away for 3 years. This is how, as I said, half of all money currently is raised in this country. So we'd have to do that kind of method of lending.
But how does that suddenly start making a different world in terms of the atmosphere and the intelligence of the economic decisions that people start making?
How does that stop the
era of red braces and drunken orgies and stupidity?
Well, first of all, you introduce back into the banking system the sense of duty of a fiduciary, in that you're custodian and you're safekeeping on one side of your banking business, the custody of deposits. On the second side, you introduce back the very noble concept of banking, which is that you are simply an intermediary between a saver and a borrower. This is something that seems to have been lost. Bankers are no different to estate agents who match a buyer and seller of a property. They have, you know, regular offices on high streets. Not ginormous temples of greed built in the City of London, because they can't abuse their current creditors, which is the current situation that we have in banking. So you introduce fiduciary as I've mentioned on the
and the way that that asserts itself is that if I, a depositor, see a banker carrying on in the old bad way, I withdraw my money from his bank?
Well, no, a banker can't touch your money if you've had it on, if you have it on demand deposit. He's a custodian of your money.
Yes.
Yeah, it's not his property to touch.
But if I, yeah, so in other words, in law, he cannot do these crazy things.
Well, in law, he can't do it. If he has to be 100% reserved on your demand deposits, he cannot, full stop, end of story, do anything with your property.
So essentially, this is a legal change you're talking about.
Yes, and an economic change, because if you mandate him to do something with your property, you say, I'm going to lend the money in terms of a time deposit format, then that banker has a given amount of real savings of the Bryans of the world to match
Point I'm getting at is that economic life does not consist of people never making mistakes.
No.
On the contrary, it consists of people making mistakes all the time, but being punished for it.
Yes, so your time, so the banker then, if you think about it,
how are bankers' mistakes punished? That's the question I'm asking.
Well, they're not punished in this environment.
They're not punished now, but how will they be in the world you describe?
If he takes your savings and invests it and lends it in bad businesses, then he'll go bust like any other business.
And that'll happen very quickly.
Well, that will happen just as it does in any other business. It's simple as.
Bad decisions.
That's right. But I think the key point is an individual bank, and by the way, there'll be a multiplicity of individual banks as there was historically. An individual bank going bust because of bad business decisions cannot cause a systematic wide collapse of the banking system, because it can't in itself cause a bank run. Mm. Because in a bank, let's say if Bank A went bust, everyone in the whole world, in the whole world of this economy, is now spooked. They walk into their banks and they pull out their cash reserves, so there's no bank run. Yeah, the bank performs, the cash is provided. Yeah, so you cannot have a system-wide collapse. So it encourages sensible lending.
So in the same sort of way, if you suddenly go crazy and start making stupid decisions in your business,
I go bust.
There isn't a fish run that spreads all over the world.
No,
Mad
Toby just goes bust.
And all your employees are out on the street, and all your customers stop getting fish, and that's all that happens.
Yes, and they'll get it.
And the other fish people move in.
But there's a more interesting point here.
And that's what happened. So in other words, the banking world would become that alternative we referred to of a more judiciously run, less violently fluctuating world.
That's correct. And your point about why would it therefore be less fluctuating? Another great Austrian insight was the subjectivist theory of value. Now, the economics profession, if you talk to any economics professor, they'll say, oh yes, of course, we know, you know, value is subjective, and yes, all of that stuff the Austrians did is all completely absorbed into the body of knowledge, and the Austrians for 100 years haven't had anything valuable to say. But one thing that wasn't absorbed into the body of knowledge, which is a glaring omission by the mainstream economists, I just call them simply neoclassical economists. They may be Keynesian, they may be monetarist, they may call themselves free market, they may call themselves classicalists, they may call themselves anything. To me, they're just one big blob, all practicing the same fallacies. And this is whereby they assume capital has some kind of mythical property to it. The reason why this plant here that we're sitting on could generate a rent, for example, is because it has some mystical properties. It's productive. They call it the marginal productivity theory of capital. They don't explain why is it productive. They just assume it's productive because it's capital. And this is a problem that stems from Adam Smith. He defined capital in this way. And really, the subjectivist theory of value tells me, this plant has an interest or a rate of return on it, because people value the goods and services that it produces, and they value those goods and services on a time preference basis, which is how we generate why there is an interest rate.
Yes.
Now there's an interest rate because I value my present consumption more than I value my future consumption. So therefore, things that are most urgently required by me, I pay now for.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Things that I don't urgently require, I'm prepared to forego consumption for, and lend to people who've got a higher time preference, who need things now and urgently in the future, urgently now in the present. Yeah.
Yes.
Now that differential, that price differential between those two competing things, present consumption and future consumption, is called the interest rate, and the interest rate is society wide. The money market interest
rate. It's not something the government just twiddles around with.
No. The money market interest rate, which it does twiddle around with, is but a small part of that whole great big
the true
interest rate.
Yes.
Now that true interest rate here in this company, and why the capital in itself is not productive, is because I'm exchanging my present goods, the goods that this factory, calls up and produces today, to satisfy my current needs, now, and the difference that I'm left with is my profit, which is my effective rate of interest. So the rate of interest is profit across society. Now you see, when you're a banker, you're ideally sorting out, you're like the intermediary in the middle between those present needs and those future needs.
Yes.
Yeah. Now that's what bankers historically will hone themselves in for, as being the mediation, and effectively setting the interest rate or the profit rate in society. They're not setting it; they're the
they're judging it.
Well, their judgment is instrumental towards that process.
Yes.
Towards matching the present and the future needs.
Your central point, and our central point, is that a completely depoliticized banking industry does that a whole lot better.
Yes.
Than political.
Yeah, six or seven people setting an interest rate, the money market interest rate, and what the price of the commodity of money is central planning on a massive.
We're right back to your very original point.
Yeah, it's central planning on a massive scale.
Yeah.
And it's proven time and time again that it fails, and it's failed now.
So in other words, we've got a sort of Soviet banking industry.
Yeah.
With all the things you would expect from Soviet banking industry.
Yes, it should.
Massive malinvestments and rotting, rusting equipment, and
yes,
things go bad.
It should actually come as no surprise to anybody. Now, this banking reform proposal that I'm advocating, that I've described now, there are five Nobel Prize winners who've said similar things to this. Milton Friedman being one, Maurice Allais being another, James Tobin being one, and Friedrich Hayek, and actually a chemistry Nobel laureate in writing in the 20s, Soddy. Now, interestingly, this idea, which would hitherto have been viewed to be crackpot by mainstream economics, has certainly now got the support of at least eight current Nobel Prize winners, and there are 36 economists of the great and good in America, economists and sort of political thinkers and so on and so forth, who have endorsed Lawrence Kotlikoff's proposal. He's a Boston economics professor, of limited purpose banking, which proposes a very similar way to restructure the banking system, which I'm happy to talk about. And Mervyn King also endorses this as well, the current governor of the Bank of England, which does propose a very similar type and style of banking. There are subtle differences that I'm happy to talk through, but he misses the point about the ability for us to print up enough money to take out the current creditors of the banking system and uplift the assets and pay off the national debt. But that's he's very, very much a mainstream author.
So this stuff is spreading fast.
Yeah.
Well, we haven't time to explore this any further, Toby. Well, we have, but I'm going to cut it off.
You'll read
now. It. We can come back to it, maybe. Nothing says we don't have another of these at some point.
Mm.
In the meantime, the place to follow this up is the Cobden Centre website.
Mm.
I came in here with lots of printouts from your blog. Some of them are things you've written yourself, including a written version of the proposed change and all that stuff about changing the way bank accounts are organised. Some of them are printouts of other people's writings. De Soto, you mentioned, I noticed you'd excerpted a great chunk of one of his books, which is well worth reading. And in general, the Cobden Centre will be the place to go if you want to follow this up. And of course, you'll find links to all sorts of other enterprises that are pushing the same kinds of ideas.
Yes, we like to think we're the premier site which seeks to make money honest. And if you make money honest, you effectively have to make government honest, because it can only then go to its people and its citizens.
You see, that's the bit I find a bit unconvincing, that you're going to be able to actually accomplish that. But maybe we can argue about that at the next one.
Shall I tell you what may well make that happen? And I don't want this to happen, and I don't want anyone to say I want this to happen, because I witnessed the currency crisis firsthand in Iceland. 15% of my purchases came from that country. I think the country is dangerously close, this country, dangerously close to a full-scale currency collapse. And the reason why is because we spend, every £4 we spend, we borrow another pound. Now, last year, the government raised £200 billion through, it created out of thin air, £200 billion through quantitative easing, of which £183 billion of that money went to buy government debt, i.e. monetize government debt, i.e. debase the currency. I cannot be clearer than that, debase the currency. Now, even if David Cameron wins the general election, he is faced with the same problems that Alistair Darling is facing today. And most of the government expenditures are already committed to. They need to take £170 billion off the spending line, and there's not the political will to do that. So more monetization, more debasement will take place. And ultimately, at some point in time, you can debase no more.
Yes, there's a limit to how much thieving you can get away with, isn't there?
And that's when I say currency crisis ultimately could force these issues very much to the fore. We nearly had it in Lehman's. Lehman's was nearly the moment when these things could happen. A currency crisis would force the issue, because you'd have to reconstitute the whole system, and that's the opportunity to start having proper discussions with people about trying to implement a system that will be robust going forward. So I'm not despondent, but I...
It's a pretty depressing reason to be optimistic.
Yes, unfortunately it is, Brian. It pains me to even think about that, because it's the ultimate impoverishment of the nation and its people and its citizens to force about a sensible reform.
Yeah. I mean, there are two kinds of intellectual optimism. There's the one which says the ideas are spreading, and the other which consists of the ideas are spreading because all the other ideas are blowing up in people's faces and causing utter misery. And we're optimistic more in the second kind of way than the first kind of way, I fear.
Yeah, I do fear, and it is fear. It is a fearful way to look at it, but I think that might tip it over the edge. But we must never give up hope, and we must always, when you know something is right, I feel you must always continue to say it. The Soviet Union, Ludwig von Mises in 1920 had already proven categorically that it could not work. Socialism cannot economically calculate. Mm. Absent the price mechanism, and you cannot economically calculate. Case proven, job done. It took 70 years for it to collapse. This system will collapse without a shadow of a doubt, whether it's tomorrow, 5 years, 10 years.
And the hope is that when it does, there'll be enough people who know what the alternative should be for it to be an improvement.
Yes, that's right. And I'm very much encouraged by serious mainstream thinkers who endorse the proposals like Kotlikoff's, even though I think the De Soto one is infinitely better because the ability to discharge national debt.
Well, I can see this could go on forever.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to have to guillotine this and say, Toby Baxendale, thank you very much.
Pleasure. Mm.